From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start the hour in Africa because Somalia is reeling from the worst terrorist attack in its history. The death toll from Saturday's massive truck bombings in the capital, Mogadishu, is now more than 300. Hospitals are overwhelmed trying to treat the hundreds of people injured. The BBC's Anne Soy has been following this story from Nairobi and neighboring Kenya. And the government in Somalia blames the al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab group, which has been waging an insurgency in Somalia since 2007. Al-Shabaab hasn't claimed the bombings, but is it safe to assume it was them?
Well, the government and the people of Somalia, when you talk to them, they sound pretty sure that it is the Al-Shabaab that carried out this attack. However, unlike other attacks that we have seen in the country and even in Mogadishu, the city, where Al-Shabaab has been quick to claim responsibility for, this particular one, they have been very silent. They haven't claimed responsibility. And given that this is the third day since the attack happened, it's very telling. So one theory is that because of the death toll, because of the devastation, they're very careful to make sure that the public sentiment does not turn against them, which is an interesting thing to say in this context, because for a city that has suffered, and even a country that has suffered incessant attacks from the Al-Shabaab, you would have imagined that the public is totally against them, but that may not be the case. But this could be a turning point.
Then why would they do it, if in fact they did?
There is a chance they did not anticipate that it would have been this big. So I have talked to some people who witnessed the attack firsthand, and they say that there was a traffic jam on the road and this truck was stuck in traffic. So they are not sure that the target was that particular place where the truck was stuck at that point in time, because it was in the middle of the road. There was a lot of traffic. It's a very busy intersection. So it could have been anywhere else. Yeah. So that could be one theory, that they may not have been targeting that particular place and the kind of casualties that came out.
Right. Well, and we are thinking of other truck bombings in 1998 against U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. This was the first many in the world heard of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. It was, of course, years before 9/11. Al-Shabaab is al-Qaeda related, but as you say, they have not claimed credit. People must be reeling from this.
They are. People have been going to the scene of the attack, you know, trying to look for their relatives. It's a lot of devastation. You know, some bodies could not be recognized. They were either burned or, you know, there were just parts available. And the ones that cannot be recognized, we are told that there is a plan for a national burial, a mass burial for all of them. And this is a country also that, you know, has not been stable for quite a while. And so even basic services like registration of persons is very difficult. So they're fearing that they may not really know the full magnitude of this attack, because there's no record of persons. And, you know, there's no technology for DNA identification as well. So it's a very difficult place to be for that country. More than 300 people were injured, so it is expected that the death toll will continue to rise.
By the way, remind us what the insurgency is about. You mentioned Somalia, you know, is struggling to begin with. What's the insurgency about?
Al-Shabaab is a homegrown group, and, you know, staging such a big attack within the capital, you know, at the heart of the city, is really a very strong statement. There are government offices nearby, including the office of the foreign minister. And so this is a really daring attack. And given the magnitude of the bomb that was used, it could not have been assembled by local homegrown Al-Shabaab militants. There has to be some foreign element of, you know, sophisticated technology that was used, engineers who participated in assembling this huge bomb that just, you know, flattened buildings around and set vehicles on fire. The devastation is really has really caused a lot of anger from the people. And for the first time, we saw a huge protest of Somalis in the streets, an anti-Al-Shabaab protest. And that is what Al-Shabaab doesn't want. And that's why it is not expected, or it is not anticipated, that they are going to claim responsibility.
The BBC's Anne Soy in Nairobi, Kenya, commenting on the truck bomb in Somalia Saturday. Anne, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us now via Skype is Senator Ben Cardin, who's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, other than the terrible human toll in Somalia, what are the consequences here for the U.S.?
Well, it's a horrible tragedy, and our prayers go out to those who were victimized by this act of terror. We know that there are forces in Somalia that are trying to disrupt an orderly way to restore democracy in that country, and we can't let them succeed. We have to continue to support the democratic movement in Somalia. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be challenging. It's not only the internal terrorism we see. Some of this is coming from outside of Somalia.
There are also reports today that Iraqi forces have attacked Kurdish fighters in the city of Kirkuk. The U.S. military today said the exchange of fire was a misunderstanding. What do you make of it?
Well, we know that there are competing forces in the region, and miscalculations occur. We have to stay focused because our coalition is a fragile coalition made up of different interests, and we have to make sure that we avoid these types of conflicts. Obviously, they can become deadly, and they can really disrupt the end result, which is to have representative governments for all communities.
You think it's a coincidence that this happened right after the president decided not to recertify the Iran deal?
I don't know if there's a relationship there or not. Clearly, the president's decision not to certify in Iran was one that was met with disfavor globally. I don't know of any country anywhere in the world that supported what President Trump did.
Other than Israel.
Other than Israel, right. It makes it more difficult for the United States to have the credibility globally to negotiate agreements, whether it's Iran or whether it's North Korea or whether it's Syria. It just puts us in jeopardy as far as our world credibility is concerned. We don't live up to our agreements.
So just going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, if the Kurds and the Iraqi government do turn against each other, what should the U.S. do?
Well, the Kurdish issue is a challenging issue. It's not a simple issue. We know that they want independence. We also understand that there are Kurdish issues in many other countries in addition to Iraq. So you can't necessarily just settle one area in Iraq and expect that the region will be peaceful in regards to the Kurdish populations. So it needs to be dealt with in context to a government in Iraq that represents all the ethnic communities and can maintain stability and avoid extremists and terrorists having a safe haven in their country.
And so you see the future of Iraq as one Iraq, not multiple Iraqs governed by different populations?
I think the governance of the Kurdish population in Iraq is something that has to be resolved. There are different alternatives that could be without an independent country. But that issue needs to be resolved to the satisfaction of the Iraqi country as a central country, as well as the Kurdish population.
On the Iran nuclear deal, you were one of four Senate Democrats who opposed that agreement in 2015, but you were against President Trump's decision last week to refuse to recertify the deal. Now it goes to Congress. What do you think Congress should do?
Well, let me tell you where I think Congress needs to be very careful. We don't want to do anything that would violate the JCPOA, that's the nuclear agreement, because then the United States would be the party violating the agreement. Iran would be free to do whatever they wanted to, and the United States would be the guilty party. Secondly, we can't do this in isolation with Europe. Congress cannot renegotiate an agreement. Only the president can do that working with our European partners. But there are problems that we need to work with. Congress has already passed new strong sanctions against Iran for non-nuclear violations. The president should implement those sanctions that we passed. There are areas within the nuclear agreement that should be talked about sooner rather than later, including how do you enforce Iran's commitment never to have a nuclear weapon, particularly after the sunset dates. There are issues that should be talked about now by the president with our European allies and all the partners in the nuclear agreement, but Congress can't do that.
Has the president talked to you about this as the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee?
I've had conversations with his representatives on this issue, including his national security advisor and the Secretary of State. I've not talked directly with the president about it.
We learned today that President Trump is going to go to Asia next month, and among other things, he's going to be having bilateral meetings with President Duterte of the Philippines, who human rights groups have accused of directing thousands of extrajudicial killings in his country's bloody crackdown on drugs. Do you think it's appropriate for the president to be meeting with him?
Well, I think the president has the right to meet with heads of state, including the head of the Philippines. But I do hope that he will make it very clear that he will be raising these human rights concerns. The president of the Philippines has had an open war against its civilian population and has had a lot of extrajudicial killings. That is unacceptable. And if the president meets with the president of the Philippines, that needs to be on the agenda, and there needs to be public statements made by the president. Otherwise, it gives credence that it may be acceptable behavior.
That's Senator Ben Cardin, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Firefighters in Northern California feel they're turning a corner in fighting the wildfires, but still, 75,000 people are evacuated, 5,700 homes and businesses destroyed, over 40 people dead, the most important statistics. But people are also looking at the economy. Napa's wine country was hit hard, so was cannabis production. Marijuana is a $21 billion industry in California, and recreational pot isn't fully legal yet. State voters approved a law last November. Retail sales are set to begin in January. Hezekiah Allen is executive director of the trade group, the California Growers Association. He joins us by Skype. And Hezekiah, I can hear listeners, you know, fill in the blank jokes about the marijuana crop, you know, going up in smoke. But this is serious business.
I mean, absolutely. You're right. It's hitting us just as hard. Unprecedented, devastating losses are really the only way to describe it at this point.
Yeah, well, most farmers, we understand, lost about a year's worth of work, not just the plants in the ground, but the harvested product.
Yeah. So, you know, we're in the middle of harvest season right now. So that means a lot of folks had plants, you know, maybe in their drying sheds. Maybe they were in the process of trimming them, of sorting them. A lot of work going on the farm this time of year. But we've got about 30 individual farms that have suffered significant losses to their crops. And, you know, a lot of folks are just getting reentry into evacuated areas. So we do expect those numbers to continue to grow.
Yeah. And by the way, you are really communicating how serious a business this is. This isn't people with pots on their porch. Talk about what some of these farms look like, the bigger ones.
Sure. You know, I mean, all cannabis grown in California is grown at a pretty small scale. But, you know, folks have probably seen maybe a farmer's market farm, you know, couple acres of mixed crops, livestock, and then, you know, you got your cannabis somewhere mixed in. And, you know, they're definitely, these are commercial farms. This isn't hobby grows.
Talk a little bit more about this. Again, as an industry, people who are growing in California have invested in permits. What's some of the money involved?
Yeah, you know, licenses will be available for the first time in California's history on January 1st of 2018. And so in the lead up to that, folks have had a lot of work to do to meet different regulatory requirements to be ready for licensure. Baseline, we're probably talking about $75,000. We've seen some projects run as high, you know, as a few hundred thousand or even more than a million if there were some, you know, maybe some environmental damages that they needed to clean up.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that people have had to spend $75,000 or up to a million?
Yeah, and that's sort of a baseline. You know, pretty typically the cost of permitting and the cost of compliance is you know, probably closer to $100,000, $150,000, even $200,000.
Well, and is there crop insurance for marijuana?
You know, this time next year, I think I'd be able to answer yes. But at the time, there are a few underwriters that claim they have policies available. No one that I've talked to has them. So, you know, it's sort of emerging in real time. And as far as I can tell, crop insurance won't be helping folks out.
Well, do we understand, too, that marijuana growers aren't allowed to put the cash from their sales into banks?
You know, that is absolutely true. We did have one report heartbreakingly enough, that not only was the home and the crop lost, so was the all cash savings that the grower had to keep on the farm. And this is one of those risks of not being able to put your savings in the bank.
Why can't they? I mean, medical marijuana has been legal in California since 1996.
The banks are regulated at the federal level. So until we see federal policy change, we're going to continue to face limited access to banks.
Huh. So what happens now?
I mean, right now, our hearts and our thanks are with the first responders. Everyone's got to stay safe and get through these fires. And, you know, I know a lot of our folks that I've talked to are really scratching their heads and pretty heartbroken about how they're going to make it to next March, which is when we'll plant our next crops. And then, you know, really how to make it to next harvest in October, a year from now.
Well, we know you started a YouCaring page to help raise money for the members of the association. Hezekiah Allen, executive director of the California Growers Association, the statewide trade group for the marijuana industry, a $21 billion industry in that state. Hezekiah, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, a 27-year-old victim of the Las Vegas mass shooting woke up from her coma on Friday. Tina Frost was shot in the head at the Route 91 Harvest Festival and has been in a medically induced coma and on a ventilator. On Friday, she woke up and walked for the first time with the help of nurses. Doctors called it miraculous. The shooter in Las Vegas, as we've heard, used rifles fitted with bump stocks, which allow semi-automatic rifles to fire like fully automatic weapons. The devices were invented by a company in Moran, Texas, called Slide Fire Solutions, though it's not clear whether the gunman used their products. Christopher Connolly of member station KERA visited Moran to ask residents what they think about calls to ban bump stocks.
If it's Friday night in small-town Texas, the place to be is the high school football game. Moran is no different. The Bulldogs take the field in purple. Moran is tiny. About 270 people live here. On the field, it's six-man football because a full team isn't possible.
It's a very unique town. Country.
Gail Brown has lived here for 30 years.
I guess the best country town I know of. But, you know, our kids grow up here, move away, and they all come back eventually.
That's what Jeremiah Cottle did. After years in the Air Force, Cottle came home to Moran. He invented the bump stock and founded his company, Slide Fire Solutions. Bump stocks replace the part of the rifle that rests on the shoulder. The devices use the gun's recoil to bump the trigger into the shooter's finger again and again to fire nearly continuously like an automatic weapon. A promotional video equates it with freedom and the Second Amendment.
By daring to put on parchment what our founding fathers felt deep in their hearts, the long, silent soul of liberty rose up. From a commoner's dream to become every man's birthright.
In 2011, Cottle told the newspaper in nearby Albany, Texas, that he created the first bump stock because he couldn't afford a fully automatic weapon, but he wanted the thrill of one. The company sold more than 35,000 units in its first year, making over $10 million. Cottle and Slidefire didn't respond to requests for comment. After the shooter in Las Vegas used weapons fitted with bump stocks to kill 58 people and injure hundreds, orders for bump stocks surged. Slidefire stopped taking orders so it could catch up with demand. But lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, are now saying the devices seem to circumvent the tight federal restrictions on machine guns.
Fully automatic weapons have been banned for a long time. Apparently, this allows you to take a semi-automatic, turn it into fully automatic. So clearly, that's something we need to look into.
A tide is rising against bump stocks. Texas Senator John Cornyn and others have called on federal regulators to revisit a 2011 decision saying bump stocks are legal. Even the typically hardline National Rifle Association called for tighter regulations. The Brady Campaign to End Gun Violence filed a lawsuit in federal court, alleging that Slidefire was negligent when it made the devices. And in the House, lawmakers from both parties introduced a bill to ban bump stocks. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a similar bill in the Senate.
Regulations aren't going to do it, and the ATF has said as much in a letter to a congressman a year or so ago. We need a law.
In Moran, folks are watching the debate and worrying. There's not much to this tiny town. A bank and a school, a little restaurant, and a liquor store. And Slide Fire has become a pillar of the economy here, with 26 employees, according to the Albany News. I met Shackelford County Commissioner Lanham Martin in front of the town's old brick post office. Martin says there was talk of shutting this post office down a while back.
If it hadn't have been for Slide Fire doing all of their mail order, or a big portion of their mail order anyway, through this post office, we'd have lost our post office. As it was, it closes at noon every day.
As for the current calls to ban bump stocks, he thinks it's foolish.
It's a piece of plastic. It's a product. It's not something that if I lay it here on the hood of my pickup, it's going to jump up and try to shoot me.
Back at the football game, that's a pretty solid majority opinion. This is gun country, practically everyone told me, though one man did say he didn't think bump stocks should be legal. Most people are like David Brown, just glad the business exists.
Some of my good friends work out there, and they love working out there. It's a good job, and it pays good, and that's hard to find in a little town.
Brown is an Army veteran, knows his way around guns, and he owns a Slide Fire bump stock. It's attached to his AR-15. He shoots for fun, and it's more fun to shoot more rounds, he says.
It's like the guys that buy a car and go add wheels and add this and add that. To a gun guy, you buy an AR and you add stuff to it. You add a pistol grip, you add a bipod, you add a scope, you add a bump fire stock, you accessorize.
Folks in this tiny town say they're horrified by what happened in Las Vegas. But that doesn't mean they think banning bump stocks and shutting down a local business would do much to stop mass shootings in the future. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
At least three people are dead and thousands are without power as the remnants of Hurricane Ophelia hit Ireland with high winds and torrential rain. Ophelia has weakened to a post-tropical cyclone, but earlier it was the strongest eastern Atlantic hurricane on record. Joining us now is the BBC's Ben Ando. He's in Warren Point in Northern Ireland. And Ben, what are you seeing there?
Where I am is on the coast of Carlingford Lough, and that's the inlet that separates Northern Ireland, the southeast corner, with the Republic of Ireland. So to my right I have the Cooley Mountains of the Republic, and to my left I have the Moher Mountains of Northern Ireland, and the Lough in front of me, which is very choppy at the moment, high seas coming in, lots of spray. It's a very grim, grey looking sea, and very, very high winds now coming in directly from the sea inland, blowing people around, people struggling to, certainly not able to walk, keeping upright. They're having to lean into the wind to get anywhere at all. And we've seen several people really struggling. In fact, one man came out of a bar quite near to where we are to try to get into a taxi. The taxi driver had to actually help him out because the wind was so strong. And I could see how difficult they found it, simply opening the car doors against this onslaught of winds, these very high winds coming in now. And we expect it to get stronger heading towards 5 o'clock local time here.
And again, we're not talking about the Caribbean, we're not talking about Florida, we're talking about Ireland and Northern Ireland. This is very unusual.
Everybody here tells me that from their point of view, this is unprecedented. They have never known a storm with such strength. we all know that tropical storms happen in the tropics. For them to still retain their strength when they come this far north is something that nobody here would ever have expected. And what they're doing is they're getting ready in the best ways they know how. They're doing simple things like, for example, making sure all their electronic devices or computer games are fully charged up in case the power goes, making sure they've got a fridge full of food. Lots of companies have closed today or sent workers home early. There are very few people driving around. Most people are getting in their homes, closing their front doors, and waiting for it to pass.
Now, we're seeing images from places like Galway in Ireland, already the water coming far beyond where it usually is. But also, there are images on Twitter of a very strange-looking sky in London.
Yes, that's right. The yellow sky in London is something that's being caused by the fringes of this storm, where pollution, where sand, where grit has been picked up and is traversing in the high atmosphere and is causing the sun's light to get tainted, to appear yellow. So certainly people who are not perhaps feeling the immediate impacts of what was Hurricane Ophelia are certainly seeing very interesting atmospheric phenomena caused indirectly by the passing of these strong winds and by the fact that so much dust and grit has been whipped up and pulled through the atmosphere.
That's the BBC's Ben Ando speaking with us from Warren Point in Northern Ireland. Ireland is bearing the brunt of Ophelia. It's no longer a hurricane, but there have been gusts of wind over 100 miles per hour. Schools across Ireland will be closed tomorrow. Oh, the excitement from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when Charlie finds the golden ticket in a chocolate bar that'll get him a tour of Willy Wonka's factory. So what would today's golden ticket be? Maybe a trip inside Google's parent company Alphabet's secret innovation lab known as X. And Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, was recently granted rare access to write a cover story for The Atlantic. He joins us now from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what exactly is X, first of all, and why is it so secretive?
X is the moonshot factory at Alphabet, the parent company of Google, as you said. And essentially, X works on the hardest problems of the future and tries to design companies that can answer them. A moonshot, as defined by X's leader, Astro Teller, is a really, really hard problem, number one, that has a technological solution, number two, and that technological solution has to be relatively feasible, number three. So they have looked into things like cold fusion and space elevators and hoverboards, but because they determined that those technologies were not yet feasible, they abandoned those projects. So when you put all those three ingredients together, you get a moonshot. And the reason that it's secretive is essentially that because they're working on projects that have a really, really long horizon, they've been around for 7-8 years, and some projects they've been working on for basically that entire time, they don't necessarily want to give up their secrets before the cake is baked, so to speak.
And is it just a windowless room with a bunch of people in it thinking about all these things? Or what does it look like?
Yeah, yes. It's an enormous white room. No. So it's funny. The building itself, it's in Palo Alto. It's on San Antonio Boulevard. It looks basically like a brick. It's a very boring exterior. You walk in, though, and as I described in the piece, it sort of looks like a museum exhibition of the future. There's a prototype of a self-driving car parked in the lobby. There are drones hanging from the rafters. And it's actually housed in a former mall. You sort of get that feeling as you're walking through X that this place is clearly the size of an enormous sort of commercial space. There are rooms with 3D printing machines, and there are meeting rooms, and there are sort of other rooms that I wasn't allowed to go into. It looks a little bit like a factory crossed with a modern tech company.
And what about the people inside? Are these just Google employees or what?
Well, yes, they're Alphabet employees. So X is considered a company alongside Google. And it's a lot of nerds. It's a lot of geeks, essentially, who have decided to go to X because they don't necessarily want to work on incremental commercial innovation. What they want to work on are the hardest problems. So I had one person tell me that he had been working. He had come from Xerox PARC, another research lab in Palo Alto. And he had been working on a microwave that could tell the number of calories of anything that was in that microwave. And he decided to abandon the project, not because they thought they couldn't sell it, but because he read some research that said that people don't change their eating habits just because of the caloric content of what they're eating, being knowledgeable of the caloric content of what they're eating. So he said, look, if this new microwave isn't going to change the world, isn't going to change people's habits, then why should we make it? And so I think that sort of speaks to the fact that a lot of people have chosen to go to X because they want to work on problems that are going to make a difference. That doesn't make them angels. You know, there are problems with X. But I do think that it makes it an interesting sort of negative to the dominant narrative of Silicon Valley right now, which is that it only works on minuscule problems for rich millennials.
One of the problems with X is one of the things that has come out of X, which is Google Glass, which was kind of a flop.
Oh, it was a total flop. Glass was an absolute failure, and people at X acknowledged that. And I think their conclusion would be, we sold Glass as if it was a product, and it was not a product. It was a prototype. It was a science experiment, and we gave it a box and a logo and a marketing platform that made it look like it was the next iPhone, and that was a huge mistake. And X concluded, I think, that they had a really problematic gap, a research product gap. There are deep, deep geeks there who are scientific minds. But a company needs a lot more than geeks. It needs consumer research and marketing and salespeople and product managers. And so X projects now go through a more formal process that takes science experiments and turns them into products so that the next thing that comes out of X doesn't make the same mistake that Glass did.
What is the business purpose here for Google? Is this a way to find the next thing that will actually make money for Alphabet, the parent company, or what did you find?
The answer that somewhat at X would give, the answer that they gave me, is that they're trying to build the next Google. That Waymo, for example, which came out of X, is their self-driving car company, and Morgan Stanley valued it at $70 billion already. Project Wing is their drone division, and if drones become a huge part of the future of infrastructure, then that could be very important. Project Loon is their internet balloon company, and if they are successful at delivering internet to the 4 billion people around the world who don't have internet, that's a huge slice of an enormous economic pie. So what they would say is, we're building the next Google. Here's what I would say in addition to that. X is a really wonderful signal, both within Alphabet and externally, that Alphabet is still an idealistic company, that its founders, who have talked a lot about how the purpose of Google is to not be evil, to connect the world, to be an information platform for humankind, you know, fundamentally, what is Google? It's a marketing company. It's an advertising company. A lot of their work is just selling keywords to insurance companies. That's not necessarily inspiring to people. But maybe having X inside of Alphabet gives off this glow that both makes Googlers feel good about themselves and makes people outside of Google feel good about the work they're doing. So I think there's both an optimistic, idealistic, and cynical view that can simultaneously be true. I mean, I think that this question is a really big, good question, and it doesn't deserve a simple answer.
What did you see there that made you think, wow, this is going to be the next big thing?
That's a great question. So I do think that Google Brain, which came out of X, their AI project, could be enormous. We have no idea how important AI could be in the next 10 years, 20 years. This is a nascent technology. But the work that was done within X on AI could put them ahead of the curve. One really interesting new product that just came out, Malta, which is an energy startup that stores the warmth from renewable energy in molten salt, is one of the like, on the one hand, like totally kooky projects, like so much other X stuff, it could amount to nothing. But if we do find a way to store renewable energy at scale so that it can be pumped back out into the grid during downtimes with, wind and solar energy, that is a world-changing technology. So I think that a lot of projects at X have this sort of interesting balance between, on the one hand, they're made with an incredible amount of idealism. They're incredibly uncertain, but they have incredible upside. And it requires, frankly, a quasi-monopolistic company like Google with steady profits in order to fund research that is as important and uncertain as this.
You know, you remind me, I took a trip several years ago to Memphis and did a story about FedEx, which is based there, and was able to tour the FedEx facility there, which is enormous. And they fly in airplanes from all over the world every single night for a few hours. And they have all the packages come out and put onto this miles long conveyor belt that, you know, then sorts it and sends all the packages to where they're going. And then the airplanes take off. And that's that. And I just couldn't believe being inside of this company's facility like that and seeing how well this works. It must have been quite amazing to just see inside of Google X.
It really was. I mean, one of my favorite projects just as a journalist to write about is Project Loon, which is their internet delivery balloon system. I was talking to the person who stitches together these balloons, which are not party balloons. These are plastic bags the size of a house, literally. Because no one has ever done this before, started an internet balloon company that flies in internet balloons 70,000 feet over the ground, the person who they hired to stitch these balloons was actually a fashion designer who had previously stitched high-end women's bags in New York. And having the conversation with her sort of spoke to me. It really resonated just like how original a lot of these projects are, that the only person in the world who could build the sort of balloons that they needed was someone who had previously stitched high-end fashion bags. I think it shows just how diverse the intelligences are that Google X has to draw from, or X has to draw from. And that was just utterly fascinating to me.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we'll link you to his cover story on Google X at our website hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Last week, President Trump referred to a conversation he had with the president of the Virgin Islands. Of course, Trump is the president of the U.S. Virgin Islands. He was speaking of this U.S. territory's governor. But social media immediately lit up with people wondering if the president's misspeak explained what they saw as a slow reaction. In a letter to congressional leaders last week, the governor, Kenneth Mapp, said there's no power on St. John, very limited power on St. Thomas and St. Croix. Virtually all of the power infrastructure is gone. And the Congressional Black Caucus has asked Speaker Ryan to authorize a congressional visit to USVI. Well, Pastor Jeff Neville is there at the St. Thomas Reformed Church on a rare cell phone. And Pastor Neville, you told us a month ago the situation was dire. How does it look now?
It's, you know, there are glimmers of hope everywhere, and some days are better than others. Right now, we had a bit of a setback over the weekend because we have tropical storm rains coming and flash flood warnings again, and just a huge setback in the recovery efforts. And of course, it kind of takes the blows to people who are already tired and wet and having to go through it all again.
Well, you're on St. Thomas. Where are people still, you know, without roofs, without homes? I mean, talk about why they are wet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was complete devastation. You don't come back from that in a month. I mean, some people have tarps on the roofs, but you get high winds and they get blown off easily and they get wet again. And you know, recovery efforts are going slow, and they're hindered by continued rains and flooding. I mean, I'm standing on the main street now, and there's water just pouring down from the hills and flooding the downtown area once again. And roads around the island are continuing to get washed out, which slows down the line crews, which prevents them from getting the power back on. And our power's off again. We had it downtown, but it's off once again. So, yeah, it's just a two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah. What about food, drinking water?
It's more accessible now, or at least it has been, for those who can afford to get to the store and stand in line and get it. But there are still a lot of people who can't afford to do that, who aren't working, who don't have an income, and they rely on the food that we're distributing. We served over 300 families with our distribution on Saturday. We'll do it again on Wednesday. And we're just, you know, leaning on private donations. Things like diapers and baby formula, things like that are our hot items.
Look, we're talking to you on a tough cell phone, which is, you know, very little other way to speak to anyone there. Mm-hmm. So I just want to repeat what you just said. Your church is distributing food and diapers and things like that to people.
Yes, we've been doing it since after Irma, and we obviously were shut down for 2 days as Maria hit, but we opened right up with my brother's workshop right next door. They're serving over 1,000 meals every day, and we've been distributing now 2 days a week as we get supplies in.
Well, look, I don't want to put you, a pastor, in the position of competing for relief, but how has it felt to see, look, in Puerto Rico, they are, feeling like they're not getting response, but we're seeing reporters, we're seeing presidential visits there. Is there a feeling that the U.S. Virgin Islands has been overshadowed by that?
It depends on who you talk to. I don't have a lot of time to read the headlines and catch up on national or international news, but what's happening here is there's a groundswell of local people working together, and we're helping each other out. And, you know, it'd be nice to have more help and more attention from the powers that be. And I know they're doing what they can, I suppose, but that's not my concern. My concern are the people here in my community that are hungry and need food and water, and we're doing our best to try to meet those needs.
Yeah. Well, and I have to tell you, we have been thinking a lot about the U.S. Virgin Islands. And then that got heightened yesterday. There's a blogger who sent out a tweet about how bad the situation is there, the huge loss of power. As you say, there's still the flooding, shortage of food, no money, people not working. And somebody in my feed who is a President Trump supporter wrote back and said, it's your government's fault. You have a broken government. Don't you have people who are linesmen who can work on the power? What's your thinking when you hear someone saying it's your fault?
I say, do you want to be part of the problem or part of the solution? We can stand here all day and cast blame on why this, you know, is the way it is, but it doesn't change the fact that it is the way it is. So let's try to get to the root of the problem and start making positive change. And you have to be positive in a time like this, and you have to help each other out. And yes, there's a lot of corruption. Yes, there's probably money that's not getting here. Look, somebody got a shipment of, they're supposed to get a generator, and it was mailed to them, and it was full of rock. So somewhere between the state through Puerto Rico to here,
the generator
was taken.
Wait, I want to be sure we've heard that. Someone bought a generator on St. Thomas from mainland U.S., and the box arrived full of rocks?
Shipped it here, yeah. And, I mean, we're still waiting for shipments and stuff. I don't know where it is. Some of the stuff is getting here, and I'm not casting any blame on anybody. I'm just saying it happens. But let's deal with what we got and do the best of what we can and move forward and work together to move forward.
That's Pastor Jeff Neville of the St. Thomas Reformed Church there on St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands, still without power, flooding from weekend rains. Pastor Neville, thank you so much, and we just wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Appreciate your support and prayers.